Sexual health is a core part of physical health. It's also a core part of mental health. Historically, there's been a lot of attention paid to male sexual functioning. Plenty of research on the topic, great medications available. For women, on the other hand, sexual dysfunction has been kind of culturally normalized to be a natural part of life, of parenting, or an acceptable part of the aging process. Sexual dysfunction is medically defined as persistent or recurring problems with sexual response, desire, orgasm, or pain, all of which can result in distress. Among women, the most common sexual dysfunction is low sexual desire. According to current estimates, 40% of women in the U.S. have self-reported low sexual desire, with the TRU disorder, so the clinical criteria, affects about 10% of adult women, 14% of premenopausal adult women. So in the U.S. alone, an estimated 9.5 million premenopausal women fit the criteria for a formal diagnosis of low desire. And of course, this can be pretty distressing to a woman who longs to feel satisfaction in her sexual relationship or in her sense of identity as a sexual being. There are currently two FDA-approved medications for low desire, and there are a handful of psychotherapy interventions, lifestyle changes, and these work some of the time for some women. But this is an area where psychedelics, specifically MDMA, may offer a bold new approach. So today's episode is all about how MDMA can support healing and wholeness among women who experience low sexual desire. Welcome to Mind Curious, a podcast for those looking to explore the potential of psychedelic compounds. In this show, we'll dive deep and test our understanding of what consciousness is, while talking to experts in the field who are no strangers to tapping into the curiosities of the mind. I'm your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Sherry Walling. Before we dive in, one common sense reminder that this podcast does not constitute medical or legal advice. The perspectives of the guests are theirs alone. They don't represent me, my opinions, or those of our sponsor, MindCure Health. Let's dive in. So, why use a psychedelic drug like MDMA to treat low sexual desire? It sounds a little salacious, right? Drug, sex, and rock and roll. The answer is actually deceptively simple. What is the object of desire, if not pleasure? Perhaps it is an impairment to one's capacity for pleasure that can cause a lack of sexual interest in the first place. This impairment might be caused by trauma, can also be caused by anxiety, depression, changes in lifestyle or responsibilities. Whatever the cause, the theory goes that MDMA has the potential to treat the root problem rather than just its symptoms, and therefore can help women get back towards a familiarity with pleasure and desire. Although this is an intuitive thought, it makes perfect sense to me. There is a stigma to the conversation around female sexual desire and pleasure. I raised the topic of desire and psychedelics with Hamilton Morris. Few people know more about psychedelic use than Hamilton. He's a journalist and scientist with a background in anthropology and chemistry. You may know him as the creator of the Viceland documentary series, Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. He's also a scientific advisor at MindCure.
I don't know what it is exactly, but there is a discomfort that people have with both their own pleasure and I think especially with the perceived pleasure of others. And it's a source of an almost mind-boggling amount of anger. And I think that that might even underlie a lot of the public support for prohibition is this idea that someone is maybe having a good time and you're out there and you're working hard every day and you're suffering and who and how dare that person have a good time while you're
how
suffering.
Irresponsible.
How irresponsible. And what if they get hurt? Then it's your taxpayer money that's going to have to save them. No, thank you. I think that's the kind of attitude. I mean, I see this a lot in my own work is people just very both projecting no matter what I'm doing. Like if this conversation that we're having right now and went on YouTube, there would guaranteed be a dozen comments that would just be like, how high is he right now? It's like not high at all. It's like 2 p.m. and I've been writing emails all day. But I think, again, the reason I'm even saying this is not to complain about people who attack other people on the internet, but just that there is this puritanical discomfort with other people's pleasure. And once you get to the point that you're harassing strangers because you think that they are in pleasure, it just becomes emblematic of the cultural discomfort with this subject. Like, I don't know how it could change. We'd probably have to live in some like radically different society where people weren't so stressed by work all the time. And I don't see that happening anytime in the near future. So maybe this is just something we all have to live with. I don't know.
Yeah. What do you think about, though, something like MDMA that helps restore a capacity for pleasure? So for those who maybe have lost the ability to experience sexual pleasure or a sense of their own happiness and euphoria.
I think it's an interesting way of treating things. And it's very different from the way any of these other medications are operating. Bremelanotide is basically an aphrodisiac. It's not aimed at, addressing trauma or any kind of overarching psychological barriers that might exist in the realm of sexual dysfunction. It's just a substance that, for reasons that I don't think are fully understood in both men and women, seems to be a rare instance of a genuine aphrodisiac. Whereas, yeah, the idea of something that is actually getting to the root of the lack of desire or the lack of ability to experience pleasure, I think is a really valuable idea.
I think one of the things that I'm curious to see is how much there'll be a sort of reemergence of the conversation around or focused on women and women's pleasure. And sort of, I'm trying to imagine a reality in which the medical community would accept interventions that are directed toward helping to promote sexual pleasure via psychedelic medications. You think that's ever going to fly?
I mean, even the way you phrased it, yeah, the way you phrased it, probably no, because the idea of promoting pleasure is not, you know, a medically valid concern. There's only alleviating lack of pleasure.
Treating female sexual dysfunction.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you have to create some kind of convoluted disorder. And even, you know, I've read who knows how many think pieces about the bioethics of bremelanotide, which used to be called PT-141 or flibanserin. And, you know, people get really twisted in knots about whether women should even be using these things, because they'll say, well, maybe there's a reason women have decreased sexual desire, and maybe this is putting a band-aid on a bigger problem or something like that. And then what I think is interesting, not to say that those questions aren't valid, they are, but what I think is interesting is you pretty much never see those questions with men at all. You never hear a man saying like, well, what kind of a society do we live in where men are expected to have erections? That's a totally unfair expectation. And maybe if a man isn't having an erection, maybe it's because there's a bigger cultural reason. And we need to think about that before we prescribe a pill. With men, this is just not talked about. No one ever made, they just say, okay, it works. Fantastic. Let's take it. And so then I wonder, is the real issue that none of these things work that well for women? Then the bioethical considerations become more prominent, because who knows if anyone really should be, forget the ethics, who knows if anyone should be taking this stuff, period. Not even as an ethical question.
It just doesn't work that well.
Yeah, if it doesn't work that well. But when you have something that actually works, I think that suddenly a lot of those ethical questions become irrelevant, because anyone that wants it will take it. And again, I think that's another reason that the use of psychotherapy is a more palatable option than daily consumption of some serotonergic agent that might produce a marginal increase in sexual activity.
Hamilton recognizes the potential of MDMA as an alternative to existing treatments for low desire, but he also stresses the importance of psychotherapy to the healing process. By the same token, MindCure Health is embarking on a clinical trial to test the possibility that MDMA-assisted psychotherapy can treat low sexual desire in women. This trial is part of an initiative called the Desire Project, a research venture which aims to drive clinical outcomes for female hypoactive sexual desire disorder, or HSDD. HSDD is more or less just another way of saying low desire. I spoke with Kelsey Ramsden, CEO and co-founder of MindCure, about the Desire Project. You and your team recently made a big announcement about a direction that you are putting lots of resources and energy and excitement. So tell me about this big new project.
The Desire Project, I am overwhelmingly excited about for a couple of reasons. One is nothing like this has been done before for women to address where we as women really fundamentally know desire comes from. And when we have challenges with desire, oftentimes we're treating, you know, other things that aren't really getting at the root of it. I'm so happy to be a woman who has the resources with our team to orient to doing the work in this way. And, you know, the second piece around it is I'm thankful that we are at a time in society where we can have a conversation about women and desire. And even though we're at the bleeding edge of it, people are open to orienting to the fact that our mental health and physical health is equally as related to our sexuality and our sexual health as, you know, the fellas have had a bit of runway on this conversation and normalizing it in a way that just women haven't had the stage yet. So I'm so grateful for that piece.
To come out and say, part of being a full, healthy human is having a sexual self, is having a, you know, a sexual identity where you experience sexuality and desire in ways that feel really congruent with you, with who you are, with what you want in the world.
It is exactly that. And it is, I think, also an invitation to women, to all of the women, because I think part of this conversation has been held in this only women who look a certain way, are a certain age, fit a certain archetype, are desirous or host desire. And that's not accurate. Yeah. It's just not. You know, like the gal who does the banking for your grandma who still goes into the till, she is a sexual being. You know, the teller at the bank and the gal at the grocery store and the lady on the bus. And at one point, your grandmother. We can hold that now, I think.
And I love the way that you're framing this conversation because it feels like it moves out of blood flow and sex organs and is really a much more comprehensive understanding of what creates sensuality, sexuality, what creates desire. So you're thinking about what's going on between the ears, the brain, the mental part of sex.
Yes, that's a perfect analogy. I think I'll steal it. What goes on between the ears translates into something that goes on between the legs. You know, I don't want to make this conversation something that is men versus women or any kind of thing like that. I think more than anything, the way that we approach sexuality can have a lot of similarities. It really can. Desire can have a lot of similarities. But for women and in our, you know, groups, in our book clubs, in our, you know, our glass of wine moments amongst our gal friends, this is a very common conversation. It's very common. This is not a revolution internally. But once we leave those places of all women, this is a revolution to treat what's between our ears as a valuable origin space for desire and really the place of the spark that then can, you know, translate into all sorts of other activities.
One of the things that we've talked about a lot over the course of the season of this podcast is the integration of the mind and the body, and that psychedelics, MDMA, offer this really interesting and I think revolutionary opportunity for mental health folk, for physicians to really get at those integrative pieces in a way that our traditional treatments of maybe talk therapy, medicine, just don't fully allow the putting together of those segments of our human existence. Mm. And so I think this project, this research study of looking at how MDMA in particular, a course of MDMA supported or assisted psychotherapy helps with desire is, again, this integration of mind and body.
You know, I think it's important always when we talk about psychedelic work to hone in on the word that you used, which is the integration of. So there is kind of this great expectation that we go and we do a course of this therapy and we walk out and we're fixed.
Bam, I'm a wonderful sexual creature all of a sudden.
Oh my gosh, I went from feeling totally unseen and unheard and disconnected to my body and not even feeling anything but wanting to feel it. And yeah, miraculously on my way home, I'm stopping in at, you know, Victoria's Secret. That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about when you go through these processes of healing and coming to understanding and the knowing deeply inside, that then we can put that into practice in a way that does not feel forced, that does not feel like it's a mental orchestration of, if I tick these boxes, if I schedule sex on Wednesday, it's going to come back. Mm. And I think most of us who've been in the game for long enough as women know that that can be helpful, but it's not necessarily sustainable or landing in the deeper self in a way that we can feel invited into desire in a way that is our own.
Which is where this holistic process of the integration component. So you can kind of be changing from the inside out, feeling more connected to your own body, feeling more interested in experience of desire. But there's still that issue of like, how do you get it on the calendar when you got three kids and you're running a business and your husband travels for work and blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
So that's also a part of this, right? How does that transformative experience then get scheduled into your, you know, your Tuesday?
Yeah, I think what I've witnessed in people who've gone through some form of psychedelic medicine and a signal in the conversation we have oftentimes, you know, a month or two afterwards is that it's so difficult to translate that experience to the other. So you come home and you tell your partner and they say, how was it? What was it like? And it's very challenging to express that. But when it's framed in a different way, and as opposed to that conversation looking like, what did it look like? And moreover, looking like, what have you noticed about the change in me? It's very easy for that relational partnership to witness the transformation and the ways we just show up differently, which is inviting to, yeah, we don't have to schedule it Wednesday. It's just going to evolve and I'm more connected. And oftentimes, even that I'm more connected to myself can spark desire in a way that you can maintain this kind of stasis point of not necessarily having sexual activity for a longer period of time because there is a richness and fullness of desire that doesn't just need sexual resolution. Like there's something beautiful in that. It's very different to the context of the heady every Wednesday.
And speaks to a sexuality that is more than just an orgasm. I mean, orgasms are great. Don't get me wrong. Big fan.
I love them.
But everybody, there's a whole experience of connection to oneself and connection to one's partner that is a piece of this equation that I'm really excited to see how that plays out in this therapy.
Me too. And I think also invites women to have the conversation about relationship to self and other. That isn't just oriented to the over-sexualization of, you know, the goal is the orgasm. Well, my friends, if the goal was the orgasm, relationship wouldn't be required because, yeah, you know, we're all pretty capable of achieving that outcome independent of the other. So why is it that we go after relationship and invest in these community systems and it culturally forever? you know, relation to other has been an important part. I'm really interested in what we find and how this rolls out. And quite frankly, I'm really interested in how this can change the way we talk about women as we go from 20 to 55. A huge amount of transformation through those years as women. And we just don't talk a lot about how that can impact our sense of self and our relationship to desire. There's a part of the conversation that is always a bit of a challenge, though, when we think about these traditional male-female dynamics. And I'm going to asterisk this by saying, so far in our conversation, we've predominantly talked about men and women, but there's a variety of types of relationship that are also suffering or exposed to this same challenge. So whether I'm with my partner is female, my partner is transgender, my partner identifies as whatever. There's a whole landscape for that. So I think it's important to put that in.
Absolutely.
I'm just so excited to be a small part in a much bigger movement in a time where people are open to it. And with women who are ready to say, I am a sovereign, womanly individual who believes in the value of my own desire and who knows that by connecting to that self other, my life will be a richer experience.
With the Desire Project, MindCure is bringing together a team of experts in sexual disorders and psychedelics. One of the most esteemed researchers on the team is Dr. Anita Clayton. She's the chair of psychiatry and neurobehavioral science at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. Her decades-long research career has focused on sexual medicine and women's mental health. Among her many accomplishments, Dr. Anita developed and validated the Changes in Sexual Functioning questionnaire to measure sexual desire. I asked her to share her incredibly qualified perspective on the discourse surrounding sexual health and the role that something like MDMA could play in potential treatment options. Is it difficult to define sexual dysfunction? Like to describe it in a very objective, diagnostic kind of way?
I really don't think it is. I think people have different experiences and sometimes they apply their own experiences. And also a lot of people are not educated about phases of the sexual response cycle. But I think if you talk with them about those or you ask the questions sort of sequentially and define terms and also don't use complicated scientific terms, I think that most people and women can give you a pretty good history mm-hmm. of what's going on with them. I don't like the word distress, which is sort of the main word used for sexual dysfunction. But if you talk about, are you angry, frustrated? Do you feel a loss? What's your sexual self-esteem like? Are you worried? What do you think the ramifications of this is? That kind of thing. I think that then people will give you those words.
Yeah, and that helps to define the line between a disorder or something that might be treated from a medical or therapeutic background versus kind of a dip in your relationship or feeling tired because of that second baby. Or how do you define or help people understand from a medical perspective that this doesn't have to be this way? Low desire is something we can treat. There are interventions for this. Versus maybe this is part of the normal ebb and flow of your sexual interest or your sexual life.
I think one of the hard things are when the woman has not had the experience of something ever before. So she has had it lifelong. So if she's never had an orgasm, if she has not really had desire, if she's asexual, those are all the kinds of things that may make it hard for her to actually define a complaint and talk about distress. And so we often have women go, well, I don't know if I've ever had an orgasm before, things like that. But if you've had the experience of desire, if you've had the experience of being aroused and building excitement and wanting this to go on, and then you have an orgasm, I think that loss is far more acute. And I think that really helps, is to talk about what's the temporal relationship to your complaint. That is, how long have you been concerned about this? Did you previously have an experience that was satisfying to you? I think timing is key in almost everything in our lives, but the timing of onset, the duration of onset. So it may not even be something that they think of as potentially contributing to a problem. The one thing that really shocks me is that a lot of women have not been educated about menopause and what happens in terms of your sex hormones, and therefore what happens in terms of the tissue that requires sex hormones to be functional. And education alone can be helpful. Lots of women don't even know to use a lubricant when they have vaginal dryness. So I think the conversation about what's going on is also part of the conversation that's educational.
What's the scope of the problem in terms of women who are experiencing less desire than they wish to?
So we did a study a number of years ago, but we wanted to understand what the prevalence was. We used one of the scales I developed, the Changes in Sexual Functioning Questionnaire, to look at women in a general population sample. It was over 50,000 women had agreed to be surveyed on any number of things. And so they received a survey. It included the Changes in Sexual Functioning Questionnaire. So we had about a 63% response rate, which is really,
it's really good for 50,000 people.
Right. And so I'm confident about these data. What it turned out when we analyzed the CSFQ initially was that about 40% of women had some kind of complaint, 6% of women with HSDD. So that is really common. And it was pretty consistent across age. As we age and get to the menopause, desire goes down, but so does your distress. Because you may or may not have a partner, or your partner may have sexual dysfunction, or you may just have slowed down. You've been in a...
You're over it.
Right. Kind of thing. So it's pretty consistent across ages. And we had women up to 102 who answered this survey. 18 to 102.
You're advising a project that uses MDMA-assisted psychotherapy as an intervention for low desire. Tell me about your hopes for that project, or at least your scientific curiosities about whether this particular compound might be a game changer for women who are experiencing low sexual desire.
So when I think about desire, and actually all of sexual functioning, we think about things that contribute to our being excited, and that could be neurotransmitters, sex hormones, and it could be other factors, the erotic stimuli we're seeing, or past experiences, and trying to catch that again, or, you know we know what we like, that kind of thing. And then we have inhibitory factors too. So it could be neurotransmitters, it could be absence of or low hormones, but it could also be past experiences too. And one of the big past experiences that contributes to not only low desire, but other sexual dysfunction is a past history of trauma. That's not the only thing by any means, but it is one thing that is not uncommon among women. And we have some medical treatments for HSDDs, but still only about 50% of women respond to each of those treatments. And that was in the group statistics in the clinical trials.
Is it fair to say that neither of those are addressing the underlying cause, if it is related to trauma or depression or more of a mental health category of cause?
And in some ways, you know, we have other taboo subjects, not just sex. So put sex and trauma, or sex and substance abuse, and all these other things together, and then people really don't talk about these things. There have been some studies looking at treatment for hypoactive sexual desire disorder using psychotherapy alone, but those studies are really don't have an adequate control. And those are somewhat effective, but not impressively so alone. The thing about MDMA agent is that it should help open your mind a bit. And then you use psychotherapy potentially to help you then focus what you need to focus on when you're open to doing that. But I think that if we can enhance psychotherapy, we may very well be able to help women get through that process in particular. Yeah. It may even be helpful for women who haven't had trauma mm-hmm. as well, because we all have baggage.
What are the pieces of information you find yourself most often talking about with your patients? The aha moments where patients are like, ooh, I didn't even know that about my own body.
So I get a lot of patients referred who have had some kind of medical condition that might impact on their sexual functioning. Mm-hmm. And that isn't just, you know, something in your genitalia. So breast cancer survivors and some of the medicines that they're taking and things like that. And I think the thing that helps is to talk through, what did you have before? What was that like for you? And what is happening now? And what do you want? Do you want to see your desire increase? Do you want to take a medicine? Do you want psychotherapy? Do you want to try something else? And understanding a woman's preferences and her needs. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to do this because I want to get this back with my partner, but I also want my partner to know I still love them. This is not about our relationship. It's about what's happening to my body.
Yeah.
What is really going on that's maybe causing this difficulty, and can they communicate about it? Because I can tell you with low desire, what I have heard from mostly men partners is that, look at her. She's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I want her, but she doesn't really want me anymore. I'm worried she doesn't love me anymore. She doesn't find me attractive, that she's already having an affair. Something else is going on, because women develop avoidance behaviors when their desire goes down. So they don't want their partner to approach them, and then they have to make a decision. Do I turn them down, or do I participate out of obligation? Because I really don't want to, mm-hmm. right? And so they'll do things to try to keep their partner from approaching them. One of the things that I learned when we visited the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta, they have a whole compound of these macaw monkeys that get a very red rear end when they're in that point where they would get pregnant and would allow sexual activity, right? But it's a very culture-driven society among them, because you've got all these older female monkeys who are watching what's going on. The young females are running around with red butts and showing them. And the males are like, I see that red butt. I don't know if I'm supposed to go after that red butt, because if they go after a red butt that they're not supposed to go after, then these older females like attack these males. So, you know, they have prohibitions too, I guess.
Everybody's like, got rules.
They do. And I started to think about that. And I think we have that a lot in our own society, especially in our own homes. Mm. So for example, if a woman is at the sink doing something, washing the dishes or whatever, and her partner sees her butt across the room and thinks, that looks good, there's nobody there to go, no, no, don't do anything about that. And so they go over and they approach their partner. And on a woman who has HSDD, what happens is she's not prepared for that. She wasn't thinking about sex. She'll say, oh, come on, I'm doing the dishes. Mm-hmm. Or she'll be thinking that, at least. And the communication is not very good. What I tell men, usually it's men, again, partners, is that probably is not going to get you sex. But here's what might. If you say to them, honey, you look great, let me finish up the dishes, you go get ready and I'll join you in a few minutes. Now, if she has HSDD, that still may not be really what she wants, but it's more what she wants than
being tackled in the kitchen.
Exactly.
I think that's where the MDMA study is really interesting, because MDMA in particular creates this subjective sense of empathy, which I imagine will be relevant both to someone's empathy for themselves around their own experience, but also towards one's partner or partners. the sense of, oh, I realize that when you're fondling my butt in the kitchen, that's your longing for me. And so this reinterpretation of those signals can be possible when there's, you know, this medicine in combination with therapy. At least that's what we're hoping to find, or we'll see if we find that.
Right. But there's a possibility. Yeah. I will say that. There's a possibility that that could happen. And that's why the therapist and what they say to help people move through this process is really pretty critical. It takes a lot of training to be at this level and to understand what is needed in this process.
Yeah. Anything else that feels important to say, specifically about the MDMA study?
Well, I think one of the key things is really we did not have a lot of difficulty enrolling people into the trials for hypoactive sexual desire disorder where we used a medication. And I think if women know about this, they may very well be excited about it. And the one thing I'm a little hesitant about is if the partner sees it and says, you need to go do this, right? The woman has to want sex. She can't be told to want sex. But I think that there are plenty of women who will be very interested in...
very excited to be excited again.
Absolutely.
Whether you're a member of the medical community, a mental health professional, or a woman who desires to desire again, you can follow along with the progress of this research project at mindcare.com. We are so excited to watch the Desire Project grow and evolve. Personally, I'm feeling pretty honored to be included in a research project that I think has such potential to help restore wellness to millions of women. First and foremost, we hope that more women will begin to share their stories as they realize that low sexual desire doesn't have to be an inevitable part of life. I hope we can help change the conversation such that mental health isn't just about the absence of a diagnosis, but is about the full expression of flourishing. Thanks so much for listening.